and it was sunny and hot. And so I went into the lean-to also because I don't like being in the sun. And when it came time for the facilitators to practice facilitating, I believe the facilitator that was practicing asked me why we were hiding, why we were trying to get away from the other horses. And that, of course, had nothing to do with it. It was the sun I was trying to get away from. And so that was significant. I mean, because it was a training, we were able to discuss that and make that known what was really happening and that sort of thing. But as a client, that sort of thing would have put me on the defensive.
Thank you for joining us on the show, Cheryl. I appreciate you.
It's great to see you. Thank you, Katie.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about who you are and how you ended up where you are now.
I have been involved with horses in one way or another since I was like probably about 11 years old. So I actually got kind of a late start compared to a lot of people, but I didn't have any horses growing up or anything. And I didn't get involved in horses till I got involved in 4-H. And that was something that was really a blessing for me because I was able to be involved with horses and work with horses. And it was actually a free lease that my leader was able to find for me, this first horse that I worked with. And that's when I first started learning about communicating with horses, but also learned about how the best way to describe it is just that an understanding of how the horse saw and understood me. And for someone as young as I was, I think that's kind of profound
For
to
sure.
feel that. And while I didn't really grasp it, I don't think until I really looked at it as an adult later, that was, I think, why I was so comfortable with that horse and with horses in general, just because I felt like they understood me and I understood their world a lot better than I understood the human world, which is, of course, what I'm involved in. So,
Can we take a second to just like bless 4-H? Like, what a beautiful organization that was able to springboard you into this wonderful career you have now as a horsewoman and author and all kinds of things because of that leader and that horse in 4-H. So I just got to throw that out there.
No, you're right. It was such a blessing to have, and the whole group was actually like that. We were all kids that didn't have horses. And this leader actually just she knew a lot of people that had horses that could be used. And they weren't show horses per se, but they were backyard horses, but we loved them. They were wonderful. So
So even at a young age, you had an interest in kind of horse behavior and that whole thing.
I read a book when I was really young, around that age, about the body language of horses, and the author's name completely escapes me right now. But I remember reading that book and realizing that there was a lot of it, you know, it talked about body language a lot of the horses and just things that we didn't necessarily understand that they could understand. Like it talked about how the horses may or may not be able to see color and different things. It's been quite a while since I've read it that just really intrigued me at that age to think that there was a whole nother level beyond what we were, you know, on the surface being taught as far. And again, I was coming into this with no experience. So I was very open, I guess I would say, to anything horse because I didn't know. So,
Well, and
yeah.
on I don't know what you don't want to call it, like you weren't spoiled yet, like your brain wasn't spoiled with or tainted with all these other things that we learn from just being around them our whole lives. It was like you had this open slate to just write whatever you wanted in it, and that's what you chose. So I think that's really beautiful.
Thank you. Me too. I was lucky. So from there, I got interested in behavior and training. And again, very young, very naive, didn't really know anything. So I did a lot of experimenting and a lot of falling off and learning the hard way and that sort of thing. And eventually got into some formal lessons, which helped a lot as far as learning balance and how to start shaping behavior. And got very interested in training. And I was with that first horse for 4 years before I ended up getting a job and being able to buy my own horse. So by the time I was 16, I guess that was 5 years, but I was got my own horse. And that was when I really even a deeper connection with a horse that I had with him. His name was Corky. The first horse's name was Splatters. And Yeah, classic. They're wonderful. Yes. Yeah, he was, it was funny, Corky was an Arabian, and you don't generally hear that name with Arabians, you know, it's fire and sultan and and that kind of thing. And he was very Corky. So, and just a really wonderful horse. And probably the first connection that I really understood, you know, horse to human. I remember somebody commenting once that whenever I walked into the barn, his eyes would soften. And I thought, that's really beautiful. And it's like, you know, we were at a show and she's like, when you leave, he looks for you. And when you come back, he relaxes. And I was like, wow, because I feel that way too. So, yeah. So that was part of that. And then from there, I showed horses. I got into training. I learned a lot of the dominance-based training stuff that we learn, and which I regret some of that. I think there's a place for parts of it and place there isn't, you know. Mm-hmm. But when I went into training, it was more of that. It was never like aggressive or, you know, I wasn't beating the horses, but right. It was the idea that the horse didn't really have the option to say no.
Yeah.
You know, he has to do what I say. And I'm not going to be mean about it. I was going to, you know, with Corky, especially you couldn't force him. You had to outthink him, mm-hmm. period. That's the only way to do anything with him. And he was a wonderful, beautiful, fabulous horse, but he was so, so smart. So I got real lucky getting involved with a horse like him. Mm-hmm. And from there, I started training paint horses. And I kind of skipped a bunch of years there. I went to college for horse training. In Illinois, and got more of the kind of the show world. You know, I had been showing, but this was like the show training world. So mm-hmm. It was very different from what I had learned before. And
so what kind of classes and things did you take? Obviously, you know, kind of some vet based, you know, stuff, I'm sure. But like, where did the behavior come in school, like in your curriculum? Because I find that so difficult of a thing to teach. Like, it's sort of a feel thing and you have to experience a lot of that stuff in order to truly grasp it. So that's something that we go through a lot, even like trying to teach our instructors and our therapists about some of those things.
Yeah. So the program that I went through was really excellent as far as exposure to different breeds of horses and different types of riding and driving. You know, we went, just saw all these different types of things. Mm-hmm. And the one thing with school, it was very, very thorough as far as the health care of the horse and training and stuff. But I do not recall actually discussing behavior so much as this is how we make the horse do what he's going to do.
Yeah, interesting.
And that is, I mean, it's very, very common. And, you know, I'm not saying anything down to that, or it's just not the way that I do things now. Mm-hmm. But it was a very good education as far as learning to understand. So as far as like the feel and that sort of stuff, I was able to develop that earlier before mm-hmm. I went there and had that ability to the timing and all of that I had already developed through my own time spent with horses and studying and the lessons that I took. I had some good dressage lessons and stuff when I was younger.
Okay.
So
what do you do for a career now?
Currently, I do part-time as a horse midwife. I do that seasonally. Mm-hmm. And I deliver foals for two different farms right now. I work with thoroughbreds, and I've done this. This is my 13th season doing that. And when I'm in the off season from that, which I used to do that full time, like year round, as far as not the foaling, but stayed mm-hmm. with the thoroughbred farm. And 2 years ago, I retired, quote unquote, and decided I wanted to focus on writing and that part of my interests. And so that's what I do now, is I focus on the writing and doing speaking engagements and book talks and that sort of thing, and working on new projects in the off season and trying to sell books. And then I do foaling in the rest of the season. So that's where I'm at right now. And we'll see how that goes for a while.
Yeah. So tell me about your books. What are they based on?
So the books are both memoirs, and I should back us up a minute, because I also had a brief 5-year hiatus from horses in general, and went to school for social work back gosh, 10 or 12 years ago now. And that is actually linked to the first book, because what happened is I had an accident with my personal horse. Her name was Farletta. She's a little paint mare. And we had that same kind of connection like Corky and I had, and just really were very, very close, very much understood her. She understood me. And that was why this accident was so shocking, because she just, it felt like out of nowhere, just panicked and bolted. And I'm not even sure what happened, but I flipped off the back of her and had a very serious, you know, fall, like 7 broken ribs and collapsed lung and all kinds of fun stuff like that. And that really shook me up, as you can imagine.
Sure.
And for two reasons. One is that's obviously trauma, but two is I don't know what happened. I didn't understand what breakdown we had in our communication that caused that to happen. And it really just made me rethink, do I want to keep doing horses as a career? Do I know what I'm doing? You know, kind of a thing. And at the same time, I was also experiencing a lot of depression, anxiety, and stuff from that wasn't being dealt with. You know, I didn't know how to deal with it. And so I just kind of did an about face, and I moved back to Michigan and went to school for social work and got my bachelor's degree and master's degree, because I wanted to go into equine assisted therapy from the mental health aspect.
Yeah.
And that was very interesting to me, just seeing how my horse had helped me in those difficult times. But what happened is, as I worked through the program, a lot of things were happening. It's without telling the whole story, it's hard. But basically what happened is I started recovering memories of abuse from when I was a child that I didn't have a conscious memory of. And it turned out I had undiagnosed PTSD from this trauma that I didn't remember. And so my theory is that that was actually what caused our accident. Is my not dealing with that part of my self, and Farletta being as sensitive as she was, just not being able to deal with that anymore. And it worked. I mean, it got my attention. I went, you know, the social work program, obviously I'm not a social worker now, and it ended up being just more than I could, was comfortable working with, that one-on-one with a client in that therapy situation, because I had so much of my own stuff.
Yeah.
I just needed to set that aside. So I started writing instead, and putting this book together. The first book tells that story of recovering the memories of how Farletta helped me with her communication and her behavior to get to a point where I understood I had PTSD. I remembered why, and I started to deal with that. So then the second book is a continuation of that story, and it goes much kind of a different direction, much more into that very intimate connection and communication that Farletta and I had, and how she helped me to recognize that there was a lot more healing to do. And this was almost more, I call it more of a, almost a spiritual journey that I took with her of understanding myself and understanding that interconnectedness that we have, you know, horse to human, but also human to each other, to the rest of, you know, we're all connected idea, and understanding energy and how energy influences horses and how energy is used by horses as communication. And that was just, it was a real journey she took me on as I learned that. And that's what the second book is about. And just a whole different aspect of healing than what I was familiar with before. So
tell me, how did your relationship with Farletta change as so we'll call it day one, you know, your accident and in processing some of that, and then realizing you had some of this, you know, these sequestered emotions and things? And how did your relationship with her change, and what types of things did you guys do together kind of as you noticed that change?
What was interesting is actually it was her behavior that caused me to realize I had to keep working on this from the accident. Is, you know, we had always been very, very close, and she was just the quietest horse you ever met. Nothing ever spooked her. That's why that was such an unusual thing to happen in the first place. And it got to the point where I would go out to see her And she would be like, oh, you're here. And she'd look at me and she'd be happy. But the minute I wanted to touch her or do anything with her, she was just like, she couldn't stand still. She would fidget and she'd dancing around. And I think, oh, okay, she's got lots of energy. I'll take her to the arena and maybe we'll do a little free lunging or something. And then she would act like she had wet cement stuck to her feet, like she couldn't move. And I just couldn't understand. It was like whenever I was with her close, she just couldn't handle it. It was very, very upsetting, honestly. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, what had happened to us? I couldn't figure out. I felt like our relationship was broken. Mm-hmm. And so instead of going and dealing with all of those things that were happening with me, as far as these memories and these things that are creeping back in, I went to find a therapist that could help me fix my relationship with my horse. That's what I wanted. And so I needed someone that would respect that animal human connection. And what I ended up with was a therapist that would do that, but that helped me to realize what was going on. Just, you know, we talked. She didn't suggest anything. She was really good. She was a social worker and mm-hmm. just helped me kind of uncover and realize some of my coping mechanisms that I was using and some of the things that I did to avoid talking about stuff. Mm-hmm. And
Was she a equine, like, did she do equine facilitated psychotherapy or was she completely out of the horse world?
Completely out of the horse world.
Interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, she really helped me to uncover that. So as I got to thinking about what was going on, I read a book by Linda Kohanov, The Tao of Equus. And in that book, she talked about how one of her horses reacted to one of her clients very similarly to what Farletta was doing. And I thought, okay, so I decided I would talk to Farletta and tell her what I was feeling and what, you know, I told her about the memories. I told her how it made me feel. I told her how unsettled I was. And I also told her that it wasn't her. It wasn't something that she was doing and that we were safe. It just had all this stuff going on. And it was like a switch flipped. She just turned right back into regular Farletta and was quiet. And just, I can, even now in my mind, I can see her just visibly letting down, like, oh, finally, you know. And it was that idea.
This is what I was trying to tell you.
Exactly. Yeah. That idea of that incongruence. And, you know, I was trying to hide everything and look normal. And I couldn't. I mean, I couldn't hide anything from her, but that incongruence was very uncomfortable for her. And I think that's true of horses in general, but for her, like I said, I've never met a horse so sensitive that just picked up on everything and could feel everything. And also was unwilling to stand in an incongruent energy like that. She's just like, we're not going to do this, you know, so you fix this or we're, you know, so yeah. And she's always like that as we went on. I could always tell when there was something I needed to work on because her behavior would change.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be like, what did I bring to the barn today?
Yeah. I want to just, you know, give you flowers for having the introspection to think about that from your point of view, right? I think a lot of people that especially have grown up in the horse industry their whole life might walk into that situation and be like, what's wrong with Farletta today? Like, why is she being so naughty? Why does she have all these behaviors, you know? And then we're trying to correct those behaviors when if we, you know, maybe look a little deeper, it might be something else, right?
Yeah. Yeah. She taught me a hugely important lesson about horses there in that is to be curious about behavior and not, I often had thought that, you know, if somebody had, you know, if I had tried to train that out of her, at the very least, I would have missed all of that learning. But at the very most, I would have been, at the worst, I should say, I would have, it would have been horrible for her to, it's almost like putting duct tape over your mouth and saying, sorry, you don't get to communicate. You know, I'm not going to let you do that. If you do that again, I'm going to hit you with this end of this lead shank, you know, stop trying to talk to me, whack, whack, whack. And because that is behavior. That's communication. Even when they're acting, you know, what we like to call it dumb or silly or stupid or whatever, or naughty, you know, whatever those words are, that's all communication. They're trying to tell us something. So if we could try to be curious instead of assuming they're being bad, I think the whole world would open up to us horse people.
Yeah. And I love the parallel for that horse. There's so many things about horses that I'm like, yeah, this is exactly like your coworker or your, you know, wife or your husband or whatever it is, that can be true. Because if we learn how to look at other people's behavior as that communication, I mean, humans can talk, you know, so that we have that going for us. But there's other things that we do too, right? That are communicating things so subtle that we don't notice if we don't stop and take time to notice, right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And sometimes I think as humans, we think we are communicating, you know, even like we're doing it like vaguely, like you don't really want to come out and say it. So you do a lot of, you know, and that, you know, and people are like, yeah, I know, but do they really know? I think, you know, it wasn't until I noticed somebody else doing that to me that I realized that I really have no idea what that person is saying. And I need to stop doing that because whoever I'm doing that to probably has no idea what I'm saying either. And it's just, it's interesting, but the horses are so, you know, their communication with each other is so subtle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go back to what I learned about body language, and that's part of it, but it's, you know, not even close to what the bulk of their communication is. And so much of it is, I think is the energy and the intention and the, and you think about like, you know, if a herd of horses out in the wild and they're all grazing and they're doing their thing, and then all of a sudden they all just kind of turn and start going one direction, like at a walk. And why did they do that? You know, maybe one of them saw a predator, and instead of throwing his head up and going, you know, whinnying and panicking and running, which would bring the predator down on them, he just kind of like sends that message along, like, let's just move away from here for now. You know, it's just fascinating when you kind of open yourself to the idea of that kind of communication. And you see it. I do a lot of sitting. I did with Farletta. I do a lot of sitting and just watching her and how she moved and how she held herself and you know, how she held her face. And a lot of that is with the broodmares. When you go back to the foaling part, that's so much information, you know, from that. A large amount of what I would pick up from those mares would be an expression on her face, the way that she's standing this on this day. And the advantage of that, of being there every day and watching, is I get to see the changes. You know, a lot of mares would stand in a different part of their stall than they normally did. But
are you looking for a leg up in communicating more effectively with participants in your therapeutic riding and EAL lessons? Teaching Aids for EAS comes to the rescue with a range of more than 70 visual aids designed specifically for our industry. Each one has been designed by a PATH International certified professional who understands the unique challenges that we face inside and outside the arena. Visit teachingaidsforeas.com today to shop their range of fun, scalable, and affordable products, including flashcards, posters, activity boards, PEX cards, handheld cueing paddles, arena games, and more. They also work directly with instructors and centers to design custom products and solutions. As a special treat for my Not Just a Pony Ride listeners, use code HETRA, H-E-T-R-A, for 10% off your order now through May 10th at teachingaidsforeas.com.
Yeah.
So if you were somebody like sitting with a participant or somebody that were facilitating some kind of a, you know, like equine assisted learning or whatever it is, what are some key things that you might tell people to look for when just observing?
That would be, would depend on if I was talking to a client or if I was talking like teaching a facilitator, for example. Is one of the things that I got more involved in when I was in the equine therapy is the teaching aspect of that. But the big thing is, and I'll say this a lot, it's kind of my mantra, is to be curious. And one of the things that I got involved in is I was with EGALA, and they did a lot of the clean language part. And I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No, tell me about it.
The idea of facilitating a session using clean and open questions. I actually wrote a lot about this. So instead of, like, if I saw a horse, this was really hard for me to grasp too, because I understood behavior. So if I saw a horse run after another horse and bite it on the neck, I've got a pretty good idea what's going on there. But it, as a facilitator, it doesn't matter what I think is going on. It matters what the client thinks is going on. So I would maybe approach that client in this, in the processing part, and say, you know, at the beginning of the session, the brown horse kind of went and what, something happened. Did you see that? And they would say yes or no, you know, yes. And then, you know, yes, I did see that. And what do you think that was about? That kind of openness, because that allows the client to tell the story that's in their heart. So maybe to me, that looks like, you know, that one mare is trying to push this other mare around or something. But maybe to the client, it looks more like a game that he and his little brother used to play. Mm-hmm. And what an opportunity I would have missed if I had said that mare was being mean to that mare. Because that kid might be wanting to tell me about his little brother and this game that they played, you know, playing tag or whatever it looked like to him. So it took me a long time to grasp that. And I say a long time, I guess maybe it wasn't, because I was at a, training, mm-hmm. and the first day I was like, I don't get this at all. And the second day it started sinking in. And the third day I was like, holy cow, I got to write about this. Cause I just, it was just such an interesting concept to me. And so that is, the idea of the clean language, and it's, technically should be a clean approach to language, because clean language as it was originally developed is a specific style of questions. And mm-hmm. it was David Grove developed it, is the name of the doctor. But anyway, it's the same idea. So yeah,
that's incredibly interesting. I think that especially as horse people, we can get we know, you know, I say horse people, quote unquote, right? But we know a lot. We've been around horses a lot, right? And so sometimes it's hard to not lead the line of questioning or lead the discussion with what did happen, right? I think right. That's a really cool perspective.
Yeah, it's significant. It was really astounding to me. And I noticed it in myself, you know, as I would be a participant in the training, like I would take the place of the client. And I, for example, remember once, you know, I was being the part of the client, and in the role plays that we did where I was doing the training, we kept them real, you know, as far as didn't try to be a certain kind of client. We were just ourselves. Mm-hmm. And there was a horse that was kind of off in the lean to, you know, mm-hmm. and the other horses were out in the paddock, and it was sunny and hot. And so I went into the lean to also, because I don't like being in the sun. And when it came time for the facilitators to practice facilitating, I believe the facilitator that was practicing asked me why we were hiding, why we were trying to get away from the other horses. And that, of course, had nothing to do with it. It was the sun I was trying to get away from. Mm-hmm. And so that was significant. I mean, because it was a training, we were able to discuss that and make that known what was really happening and that sort of thing. But as a client, that sort of thing would have put me on the defensive. Uh-huh. Like, oh, we weren't trying to be, you know, now I'm in trouble, right? Because yeah. I was trying to. Yeah. So that's really a big deal.
Yeah. And what do you think about me? And why do you think I was being that way? And that kind of a thing where you almost get like that judgmental piece of things.
Exactly. And as soon as that part of the brain is activated, where that defense goes up, mm-hmm. then you've lost your learning opportunities, and you've possibly lost your client for the rest of that session, mm-hmm. you know, just depending on what you're dealing with, because you know, once that's activated, it takes a while for that to calm back down, but that's right. That defensiveness. And so I want to approach a client without making anything like that happen, without yeah. bringing that into the session. So,
and I think that's part of why horses are so incredible for that part, this part of work, is because they don't judge us and they don't come at us with leading questions and things. They just are here and they just, you know, are in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much. And they can show us a lot of stuff, you know, and if the person's ready at a place where they can interpret the behavior, you know, and I think the horses are really good at that too. Showing a behavior which is going to be meaningful for the client. Kind of the horses are so interesting in that way, mm-hmm. and how they can, you know, if you just leave it open and not say, oh, what happened there? You know, she kicked him, you know, none of that kind of stuff. Just be curious.
That's so, right. Yeah. Be curious. I love that. Mm-hmm. So tell me about, a little bit about how horses can help us with self-love, because I think that that is something that a lot of our participants are working on, is like that confidence, being able to even, like we just talked about, being able to be confident, even sharing things with us, confident in themselves, that type of a thing. I think that's a topic a lot of people are working on, and horses can do for us so beautifully.
Definitely. And I can tell you the way that Farletta helped me with this, and it was like an aha moment, because it took a really long time for me to get there. But again, her behavior had changed, right? So I knew something was going on. And she got to this point where she was just, she hated being in her stall. And there was other things going on. You know, she had a lot of arthritis and was having some pain issues. And we were trying to deal with that. But there was just this almost irrational appearing. And I don't want to say irrational, because obviously it meant something to her. It was rational. But she would, just the second she'd get in her stall to eat, she'd eat like a couple bites, and then she's back. It's not like we were leaving her in her stall. She'd only go in there to eat. Mm-hmm. And so I started trying to figure out how to listen to her and how to understand what was going on. And finally I started just talking to her, and it's like, Farletta, you know, you're very strong and you're very brave, and you've been through so much, and look at all that you've come through. You know, she had lost one of her eyes to uveitis, and she had been in some tough situations earlier in her life. And she, so I just kept talking to her about that. I kept saying, you know, you're very strong, you're very brave, you're very smart, you're very powerful, you've been through so much. And she stopped, and she turned, and she looked at me with her, turned her neck around, and she touched my face with her nose. And she, I could hear it. I could hear it. She, in my heart, she says, you know, you could be saying that about yourself. And that was when I figured it out, that was that profound moment. I'm like, when I understood that, the behavior, again, it changed. She was calm. She was fine. She was relaxed. And I understood that. So that idea of telling that to myself, I believe, was her lesson. And how you would transfer that into a client situation, I would say possibly even just having the client tell the horse all the things that are wonderful about the horse. Mm-hmm. And I believe the horse would work their magic from there. I really do. So leaving that opportunity open, but not being attached to outcomes, and that being as a facilitator, that goes with that whole keeping things open, because mm-hmm. the client may grasp something completely different from that activity. So let them tell you what it is. Don't tell them what it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. First of all, that story gave me goosebumps. I have no doubt in my mind that actually happened. It makes me want to cry. And I think that leaving conversation, I mean, like, okay, I'm going to say curriculum. Okay, that's just a word I'm going to use. Like, if you went into something like planning, like, this is what we're going to learn today, or this is what we're going to do today, like with your clients or your participants, you know, having a thought about what might happen is okay, but not forcing that to happen if it's not, you know, and just letting it be organic.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's significant. I think having something, you have to have something there, a thought of what you might like to happen or what you want to see, but being open to that. And I always, that's kind of how I've lived my own life. It's like, well, this is what I would like to happen. This is my plan. But if it doesn't work out, that's okay. We're going to just go this other direction. And that's fine too. And I think having that open is so significant, because, you know, that moment when the client is going to make that realization and maybe want to say something can be so fleeting. Mm-hmm. And if you jump in there with words or with other ideas or, you know, anything that can possibly block that or turn that off, it's really important to be open to that. I remember another session, and I can't remember what the lesson is that we hoped that the client would learn. We had that idea, and the horse did something in the session that was so like, wow, that is exactly what we want this client to see. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to say something so badly, and the client interpreted it completely different. And I'm just like, You know, I just,
and also, but you can't.
But no, but we can't. We didn't. And she did gain from that. And the other lesson may have come further down the line, you know, possibly processed in the next session or may, you know, it's just, there's, I think we get so intent on that idea of wanting to help and fix and bring the client to this place of realization, because we just know it's going to be so much better for them. And if they can get there, it will be probably, but if we bring them there when they're not ready, then it doesn't help. It's I think of it a lot about like the way that I think about horses now versus how I worked with them 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. If you had told me that my horse was going to look at me and tell me what she told me, I would not have believed you. I would have said, come on, you know, but I had to get to that place where mm-hmm. I was ready to hear that. And this is going to be the same for the client, is getting to that place to receive.
For sure. I totally agree. And waiting for that patiently.
Which is really hard, because we all want to be helpers, right?
That's right. This is the business. We're all helpers. We're all, you know, bleeding hearts mm-hmm. that just want to serve.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Ms. Cheryl, where can we find your books if we want to learn more about you or your social, or where can we connect with you?
All right. The books, the two memoirs, are on Amazon, is the easiest way to find them. Of course, the Zahn. And have a love-hate relationship with the Zahn. But so I also have a website, www.followmefriendbook.com. And that's my author website that's got my book stuff on there. If you go to peacehorse.net, you will find the other aspect of what I'm doing, which I'm going to start working on more developing at this point, is kind of a horse-human relationship coach.
Cool.
And a lot of just helping people, it's not training so much as looking at what your horse might be saying and kind of processing that. And that is covered more on that website. And I believe the store on that website has a link to the digital version of the Clean Language book, because I don't sell a print version anymore. So if anyone is interested in that, if not, it's on the other website. And if you can't find it, email me through the website. But I'm also on Facebook, Path of the Peace Horse, and then Hope Horses and Healing Book Collection are my two pages. And I'm other places. I have a web blog also, Peace Horse Journey, but all the links are on my website. So if you can find your way to the website, you'll find me.
Perfect. Well, for everyone listening, I'll put the link to the website and everything in the show notes. So scroll down and click there and connect with Cheryl. It's been absolutely beautiful talking to you. I really have enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you. Me too. And I appreciate the opportunity. So thank you, Katie. Yes,
absolutely. So before I let you go, we close our podcast with the same question for the season. We change them every season. And this year, the question is, what is your golden rule? So if someone were to remember you for something that, you know, the rule you lived your life by, what would it be?
It's got to be curious.
Yeah, that's what I wondered.
Yep, it's be curious. And I mean in everything. And in when you view other people's behavior, when you view your horse's behavior, just be curious. Take that first step and see, I wonder what's happening here. I wonder what they're trying to tell me, instead of going straight to judgment. So,
and assumptions. And it's only going to get you in trouble.
Yep, be curious.
That's right. Well, thank you, Cheryl. I appreciate you, and I hope to see you down the road sometime.
Yes, you too. You're welcome, Katie. Thank you.
That's all for today. But until the next episode launches, scroll down to the show notes and click on the link to get plugged in with us on Facebook, Instagram, or our exclusive educational club at Patreon. This podcast is presented by Hetra University, the educational arm of Heartland Equine Therapeutic Riding Academy in Gretna, Nebraska. Hetra University's mission is to provide high-quality educational offerings to the EAS community. Check out all that Hetra University has to offer at www.hetrauniversity.org.